Hi, I'm Mike Nakert, and you're listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, welcome back for another Chefs on the Grill podcast. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration between Hungry Magazine and Chicago Magazine, and you can find a complete archive of all of our podcast interviews at www.chicagomag.com or www.hungrymag.com. This month I sit down with Rick Bayless, the king of regional Mexican cuisine in Chicago and throughout the United States. In March, Bayless will be celebrating the 20th anniversary of the opening of his first restaurant, Frontera Grill. I caught up with Chef Bayless to talk about those early days and so much more. Enjoy the interview.
So the first thing I was thinking about, you know, obviously in March you're celebrating your 20th anniversary with Frontera Grill. You know, if a restaurant lasts 5 years in this town, that's an amazing feat. I think the thing I'm really interested in is what those early days were like for you. You know, did you have a sense that it was going to, I mean, it's hard probably to have a sense that it was going to be this big. But, you know, were you worried, you know, were people lining up outside the door the first week? You know, I wasn't here 20 years ago, so I wasn't sure. I'm curious about those times.
Well, it was very scary because I grew up in a family restaurant, and I had done a lot of restaurant consulting and teaching cooking classes and food writing, but I had never run my own restaurant, and I wanted to do something that you couldn't actually pattern off after any other restaurant. So we were starting off kind of in the dark. I was training a staff of very unskilled people because I couldn't afford to hire a staff of very skilled people. I was scared also because I had invested my mother-in-law's retirement fund and my mother's retirement fund. So talk about pressure. It was pretty intense. My wife and I did everything. We hired a small staff. We opened the door at 7:30 in the morning, and we closed the door at 1 or 2 in the morning, sleeping very little from Tuesday through Saturday. We've always been open only 5 days a week. And we did that for survival in those first days because we couldn't hire enough staff to really support the work that needed to be done. So we were doing it all, and we thought, well, we'll just be open for 5 days. We actually chose the location that we're in because we thought we could be busy for lunch and dinner 5 days a week. We had no idea whether it was going to be successful or not, but I'm a pretty tenacious person, and when somebody tells me that something perhaps that I want to do can't be done, I'll try to figure out a way to make it happen. So we had no idea what we were getting into when we opened up. I wanted to do food that was the real food of regional Mexico, not a Mexican-American food. And of course, I had just written a book, which actually came out the same day our restaurant opened, on the regional food of Mexico. And I knew it very well. I knew how to cook it. I didn't know how to cook it in a restaurant circumstance, so I had to work on that. I, of course, was very familiar with how to cook in restaurants because I'd done that since I was a kid. So I was translating home recipes, basically, into something that we could do in production. And that took some figuring out and fiddling with it. Sometimes I still think 20 years later we're trying to figure it out. But we keep our nose to that grindstone. The first customer that we had come in the restaurant, sat down, looked at the menu, got up, came over to me and said, "This is not Mexican food. You are going to fail." So those words rung in my ears. As you can imagine, I was really scared after that was the first reaction. And within a few days, we started getting some really good positive feedback. We had, as I said, a very green staff. We were trying to figure out how to do it. The best gift I think I've ever received in my life was a fellow that we had worked for in California that had a small chain of Mexican-American restaurants that my wife and I had been doing some consulting for while we were writing our first cookbook. as an opening present, he sent his operations manager to spend a week with us, helping us get all of our policies and procedures set up and to train our wait staff, because that was our weakness. And that turned out to be fabulous, because he got us started on the right foot. My wife's brother's our accountant, and he helped us get all of the business side of things set up right. And we were off and running. Within 6 weeks, I had made a projection of where I wanted to be in 6 months financially, and within 6 weeks we had hit that goal. Within a year we were beyond anything that I had set up in my projections, and we were just scrambling trying to train staff, develop enough staff, hire new staff. For the first year we pretty much kept on that routine of opening and closing the restaurant ourselves, because we just didn't, it was a small operation, we didn't have much staff, and we wanted to make sure it was all done just right. And after a year we hired a manager, and I hired somebody else in the kitchen to really help me sous chef wise, and then it's grown and grown and grown. I never really had any plans as to where I wanted to go with it. I'm always a person that says I'm going to take the next right step. That's as far as I really plan things out. And I didn't have this vision of, oh, if we do this, then we can go here, and if we just reach this goal, then we can expand over here. I just have sort of taken each step. When I got one project not completed but going well, then I started thinking, well, what's the next step to take after that? Mm-hmm. And that's the way we've grown everything that we've done. It seems like about every 2 years we've tackled something new, and that's been a lot of fun.
But that's what probably keeps it interesting for you. And
well, it does. And I don't have any great desires to conquer the world. Yeah. When we started our restaurant, I knew in the back of my head what I wanted the restaurant to be in the community. And after a couple of years, I sat down and wrote that all out as a sort of mission statement for the restaurant. And that's been really great, because it's been a guiding principle that we've worked with. And still to this day, we just had an all managerial meeting yesterday, and we read that all again, because it's an important thing for us all as a group. There's a large management staff here now. It's good for us as a group to revisit that, to think what we're doing, and to evaluate our success in terms of the mission. Now, the mission for many businesses is to make a lot of money, or to be the number one in a category. And that's actually not part of our mission statement, because what we're really interested in doing is to bring the regional foods of Mexico to life in the United States for several reasons. I mean, one is that we believe that we can learn something from it. Another is that we enjoy it. It really creates a better quality of life in our community. But then we sort of branch out from that, and our restaurants always wanted to be an asset to the community, and so we have tried to accomplish that in several different ways. One is to be a good place of employment, and what we're most proud of, I think, in this profession that is notorious for turnover, is that 60% of our staff has been here for over 5 years, and we have 10 people who have been here for over 15 years.
Wow, that's
so amazing. It means that we've created both a comfortable place to work, but also an engaging place to work, where you never say, it's all done, I've worked through that, I'm tired of it, I'm going to move on to something else. But we're always setting our sights at new heights, something new to accomplish. You know, we started a foundation a few years ago to give back to our agricultural community here. It's called the Frontera Farmer Foundation. And what we want to do is to provide small capital improvement grants for small farmers so that they can become more profitable.
Actually, I did a story on one of your farmers, Chris Covelli,
sure.
Tomato Mountain Farms, this summer.
Exactly.
I spent days up there with him,
cool.
Just watching him make his product.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
You know?
And that kitchen he built, he couldn't have done without the grant.
Exactly.
You know? So.
And that's what we really want to do, because we believe that great cuisine comes from great local agriculture. And then, you know, our restaurant buys Well, this year it was about $600,000 of products from the local farmers, and I think that that gives them a shot in the arm too, because that's our big commitment, is to buy their product.
I think all of this kind of started when you were 14 and you took your first trip to Mexico, and you know, I wondered about how that even came about. Did you always have an interest in Mexico prior to going there? And kind of what it was about that first experience that inspired the passion in you that kind of exists to this day?
I can't say that I always had an interest in Mexico. I always had an interest in traveling to a foreign country and growing up in a middle-class home that was in the restaurant business, which means that you don't have very much time off and you don't have a lot of money to do anything. I only dreamed that I would get at some point in my life as far away as Mexico, which was the next country over. I've always been interested in other cultures, and I've always loved traveling, though I got to do very little of it growing up. When I took that first trip, I was completely enthralled with the vitality in the culture in Mexico. You know, when you get into Latin cultures, there's just this sense of generosity, and it's not like sort of the uptight Northern European cultures where everything goes according to a certain plan. There's a sense of spontaneity that has always enthralled me, and it's certainly their spontaneity in the markets and in the food. And you know, you can say, well, there's this traditional cuisine, but the traditional cuisine is kind of fluid, and it changes depending on who's making it, where they're making it, what time of year they're making it. And I've always loved that aspect to the culture, because it goes with my personality. I love Latin music. I love Latin dance. I think I got more involved in the culture to begin with. You know, when I went to college, I studied Latin American culture and Spanish language and literature. And I was much more focused on language and the way that it reflects its culture. And then when I went to graduate school, I studied anthropology and linguistics, again, sort of furthering that interest in language and culture, until one day I woke up and I thought to myself, you know, really what I'm interested in more than anything is the way that food reflects a culture. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with that. I was working on my dissertation, and I was getting less and less enthralled with the topic, and even less enthralled with the fact that everybody that was graduating from my department was getting job in, I don't know, Des Moines and Peoria and places I knew I didn't want to live. And so I decided to take a year off from that. And I'd always cooked. I had a small catering business in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where I was going to graduate school.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, I'm a fellow alumnus.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Cool.
And I one of the other things I was curious about was, it's probably more of a selfish question, but, you know, what did your time in Ann Arbor mean? And you know, was there anything that's really contributed to what you're doing today?
Oh, well, millions of things. That's where I really learned to hone the craft of thinking. Because I went to undergraduate at University of Oklahoma, and it was pretty rote. I didn't have to do a lot to get through all of that. I didn't have to do a lot of real thinking. And when I got to graduate school, man, I was almost in over my head, and I loved it. I really loved the challenge of working with brilliant minds, and they taught me really how to think and how to utilize everything that I had. And there was a really good food community there. Now, this is before the days of Zingerman's. You were there after the days of Zingerman's. I left Ann Arbor the year that Zingerman's opened. They opened, and then a year later I left. And they were just getting started. And we used to go there and shop every once in a while, but we didn't quite know what it was going to become. And, of course, it's become this amazing thing now. But there was a really good food community there. The ringleader of which was a woman named Jan Longoni, and she had this wine and food library. She's really much more of a food historian, and she had collected an amazing amount of books from all over the world, but mostly from Europe, historical cookbooks and food books. And she is now considered to be one of the great authorities on the history of gastronomy. And I used to go to her house once a week. Her library, it was, you could purchase books from her library, but it was in her basement. And so you'd just make an appointment. You'd go to her house and go down in her basement, and I could just spend an afternoon there just going through every single book on the shelf. And it was more in the conversations I had with her, because her husband was a professor at the university, and I learned sort of the integrity of doing culinary research, and she really helped me to focus that. And I'd been doing cultural research in school. She kind of helped me to understand how that would interact with culinary research. And before I knew it, I was packing all my bags and heading off to Mexico to do the research. I guess, you know, I never finished my dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I kind of felt like I needed to do that dissertation. So my first book is in lieu of my dissertation project that I lost interest in. And I did the research just like I was doing it for school, except that I wanted to make it a more popular book in some ways. And but, you know, I did the research behind it is really solid and very scientific. And so I was really happy when that book came out, because I said, yeah, I finally did that project that I set out to do a number of years ago.
A lot more people probably read that book than they would have.
That's exactly right. I have a friend who does food studies in through the history department. He's moved to a couple of different universities, but he did his dissertation on the evolution of the concept of Mexican identity after the Mexican Revolution of 1910, but all from the perspective of food and how food emerged after that revolution and how new dishes became the national dishes. And I love his dissertation, and I'm sure all the other 10 people that read it do too. But it's I always think, man, why don't you write something that's a little bit more popular? Because the ideas in it are really good, but it's weighty. It's hard to get through. And I just talked to him the other day, and he's written another book on called The Sausage Revolution in Mexico. And I just think, gosh, if we put some recipes and some pictures in here, we might actually be able to get people to read this really interesting book. But, you know, he's definitely an academician.
It is. I mean, it is fascinating. I did a story on Taqueria Puebla over on North Avenue. And so one of the things I did was I just looked into Poblano cooking and looked into that whole history. And it just, even, you know, it's amazing just the idea that, you know, it's this melting pot. You know, you have pre-Columbian cultures, but you also have, you know, Lebanese, and you have the Northern Italians from the Veneto, and you have, you know, even with the Cinco de Mayo and the French occupation, and it's really this melting pot of cuisine, you know, no different than, you know, the United States, and probably richer, you know, in that sense. And so there are great stories there that, you know, and the thing that I think about and the idea that you've been doing this for 20 years, of course, you think about the evolution of cuisine since you started, you know, in 87. You've been a sort of a big, big proponent, and you've been the reason that a lot of things have happened throughout the United States in ways either people have worked for you or just what you've been speaking about in your cookbooks. And one of the things I thought about was, you know, as a food writer, I like to think that I'm conscious of the cuisine. But even for me, you know, I would say only in the last couple of years have I become really aware of Mexico as this sense of regional, you know, food. So Oaxaca, Puebla, you know, Jalisco, Guerrero, you know, all these things. And I had the sense that, you know, Americans know about Tuscany, Americans know about, you know, the Italian regions, but it seems, and through no fault of your own, of course, because you've been out there talking about it a lot, but it seems that Americans still seem to think of Mexico as one homogenous culture, right. I think, and I wonder what your thoughts on that were.
Well, I think it's changing. I certainly have been out there talking about it so much that I think I've given a lot of other people courage to talk about it or to open restaurants that feature the cuisine of just one region of Mexico. There's a sort of socioeconomic relationship we have with Mexico that I think encourages most Americans to keep Mexico in the dark in their heads. It's a little too close, and we rely on it a little too much without wanting to admit that we're relying on Mexico as much as we are, both economically in terms of them producing goods for us, but also in terms of them producing services in our culture that we don't want to admit that they're really fulfilling all of those obligations that need to be fulfilled in our country. So I think it's been a little bit harder. If it smacked of a European sophistication, we'd be all over it. You know, we'd want to know what Veracruz style cooking is compared to the Pueblan cooking. You know, there's been some resistance to that. And if you go back as far as the time when the United States took over what's now the American Southwest back in the mid 1800s, you get a sense that even then there was a really strong desire to look at Mexico as backward and not sophisticated enough to even warrant any consideration on our part. So from that time to today, and certainly through all of the 60s when the Chicano population sort of reared its head in California and wanted to be considered, you know, for what their contributions have been. There's been a reluctant give and take between the two cultures, mostly which has ended up with our taking and their giving, but not from the other side. I think there's a tremendous amount that we can learn from Mexico. Both in that generosity of spirit that I spoke about a few minutes ago, and from the variety of flavors and preparations that they put on plates, which can really enrich our lives here in the United States. I think that it's comfortable for us to look at that stuff, or at least it should be comfortable for us to look at that stuff, and to ask those questions about how, as the Mexican population increases in the United States, we can appreciate it, see how it can enrich our lives, and not be afraid of it. And I guess that's one of the things that I've been focusing on the most, is to try to make people comfortable with the culture, mostly through my television shows, because each show, of course, is half shot in Mexico. So I'm introducing people to the place that has inspired the cooking, and then come back to my American kitchen and show people how that they can make those kinds of things. And more people are sort of wandering off the path from the beach communities and getting to know a little bit more of Mexico. That's a really good thing, because unfortunately most of the beach communities that the Americans go to really don't represent Mexico at all, and in fact they're just really pandering to that American appetite. And so you don't get the food, you don't get the culture, you don't get the wonderful things that I think can really help enrich our lives here.
Sure, you can go to Outback Steakhouse.
You can go to absolutely. Well, Cancun is the craziest of all of the places, because it really is like a separate country. And when you talk to Mexicans that have immigrated to the Republic of Cancun, they talk about how hard it is for them to go back to their families wherever they are, because they don't feel like they fit in to Mexico anymore. And when you hear Mexicans talking that way, you realize that that is a separate culture that's been created there around Cancun. Now, some of the other places like Acapulco, for instance, it's a really big city, and it's got its own culture. It's kind of a little rough and ready. It's not sophisticated like you'd find in Puebla or in Mexico City, but it's a fun place to go, and it's got a little bit more character. A lot of Americans now are headed to Baja California, which is totally American. It's just recently been built up to be another alternative to Cancun. So if you really want to get some sense of, and you want to go to a beach and you want to get some sense of Mexico, I would say to people to stay away from those two places, Baja and Cancun, and instead go to some place like Acapulco, or go to, even Puerto Vallarta can be a little bit more like Mexico than other places if you stay right in town rather than out in the touristy section of the big hotels and things like that. But there are some places that people have wandered off to, and they talk to me all the time, because they, especially guests in our restaurant, will come in and they say, oh, I saw your show on this or on that, and we went to those places after we saw that, and that was really an experience that we never thought we would be able to have in Mexico, but you made it comfortable for us. That's what we're really looking for.
Do you think, you know, the other thing you think about too now in Chicago, the big new thing is sort of this pan or Nuevo Latino cuisine. You know, you've got a bunch of people around town who are kind of assimilating everything into one. And and on the surface, you're like, oh, that's great. You know, people are spreading the gospel. But then you think about it, and it also seems like by doing that, you're, again, you're muddying that indigenous or that unique nature of the regionality.
Well, I'll say a couple of things about that. One is that Mexican cuisine is the great fusion cuisine of the world. Mm-hmm. It has absorbed more cultural influences from around the world than any other cuisine, I think, on the face of our planet. So it's going to continue to evolve. I have a number of friends in Mexico that are get real huffy when they think that there's any influences coming into their cuisine. And I just have to laugh at them because that's been the whole nature of that cuisine. And in fact, when the Spaniards came to Mexico, the indigenous population absorbed all that Spanish stuff and mixed it very beautifully and seamlessly with a lot of the indigenous stuff, creating the basis of what we think of now as Mexican food. It didn't happen in Peru. It didn't happen in Argentina. It didn't happen in Brazil. Those are places where other things happen, and you get these sort of different cuisines. You get the indigenous cuisine that's still sort of remnants of what pre-Columbian life was like, and then you get the old-fashioned Spanish-like cuisine that's sort of survived there and never really been, it's never really grown the way that Spanish cuisine in Spain has grown. So the only place that you got the full fusion, in which I think created this really lively cuisine, is in Mexico. And that's why, what came out of that was this very complex cuisine. That's why a lot of the Nuevo Latino chefs want to do all of Latin America except Mexico. And they'll leave it to people like Doug Rodriguez that opened De La Costa here. He will do his little token Mexican thing here and there, but really he wants to do all the rest of Latin America because Mexican cuisine is just too complex to really get right. If you do some of the little snack foods or ceviche here or there, that's easy. But when you get into the moles and the pipianes and all that, those are really hard to get right. And it's rare that a kitchen that's not completely dedicated to those can just make a good one while they're also making a Brazilian dish. You know, that sort of thing doesn't happen very much. So I think that it's good that there's always these cultural influences that are coming into Mexico and being absorbed and becoming part of the cuisine. The whole idea of Nuevo Latino food, however, is, I think it's a disservice to the cultures. It's like saying that you can skim the top of all Latino cultures and then sort of make a mishmash out of it and create a menu. I would say for the last 15 years we've been hearing about this great new Nuevo Latino kind of cooking, this thing that's going to take the U.S. by storm, and it goes blip and then it falls off, blip and falls off. And I think it's because it's not a really good idea. I don't think that those diverse cultures can all sort of be subsumed under one umbrella, and I don't think you can make much of a menu out of it. It looks like the people that are doing sort of Pan-Asian food, after a while it's like, you know, I'd really rather have Thai food, or I'd really rather have Korean food. I don't really need to have a menu that has sort of a mediocre Thai dish and a mediocre Korean dish and all that, all on one,
right?
Because each one comes from a different sort of aesthetic or a different set of ingredients and techniques and all of that. So I'm not sure you can do the pan Latino thing.
Thinking about fusion, one of your shows that I was really most fascinated by was the show where you were, I think you were with Monica Patina, and you were talking about the fusion of Chinese and Mexican food, which I didn't know about until I saw your show, and I just thought that was really interesting, and I wondered if there were trends like that beyond that, you know that are going on in Mexico right now that are.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me that a lot of the people that start doing the fusion of Asian and Mexican end up eventually moving over into doing Asian food, They don't stay with the fusion thing. They just do more and more Asian food. And it's interesting that Monica is doing that. Her newest menus are way more Asian than they are fusion. So it sounds like a kind of interesting idea, and there's a lot of similarities, and it's fun to play around with it. I'm not sure you can make a cuisine out of it, but I always love anybody that's thinking, creating, trying to do something, push the envelope. It's necessary, I think, in any art form to have people do that. Whether it sticks or not, who knows, but at least it opens our eyes to a new way of thinking, which may then lead to something that will stick. So I don't know about the Asian Mexican fusion stuff, whether that's going to really work or not.
And locally you have Vermilion, who's doing the Indian Latino fusion, which is interesting.
It is, and you know, I always say that there are certain cuisines that relate to one another around the world, and they all tend to move toward the equator. So you get Indian food and Thai food and Moroccan food. These are all the what you call the complex spice cuisines. And there is such a similarity between them at one level that it leads you as a cook to say, wow, why don't we just kind of like take an element from one of these and put it with another one? But it doesn't always work good in the end. And there are maybe people who are doing it that perhaps aren't as talented as somebody else that could really make it work. I don't know. But it's fun to see people playing around with it. I'm not sure I'd want to stake my reputation or my restaurant's success on it.
In that vein, I think about, I know you were an early partner in Zinfandel, and which focused on regional American food. And I wondered, you know, do you have a sense that there's just too much to do with the Mexican cuisine? Or would you be interested in looking at concepts and focusing on the regionality of other areas, like America or whatever it is?
I learned a really interesting lesson in that when I the way that I love regional Mexican food, and I've studied it a lot, I'm very familiar with a lot of regional American things. And they tend to have been kind of pushed away these days as we've homogenized our society and everybody eats the same McDonald's or Wendy's. And I thought, well, we should give a place, a restaurant, that can keep alive some of those regional traditions. Because if you think about it, the food in New Mexico is about as different, it's almost like a different country from what people are eating in New England. And I thought it'd be really nice to do kind of regional American menus. And once a month, we changed the menu to sort of focus on a different part of the United States. Well, it's kind of interesting because if we did those dishes in a more contemporary style, then we would get people from those regions that would say, nope, this isn't the way my grandmother made it, and you're not doing it right at all. And then we would get people from the just that were walking in off the street to eat the food saying, I've never heard of this. Is this part of our food? And they were kind of confused about some of those things. And so after a while, I did it because I grew up in a regional American restaurant, and I kind of wanted a place that I could do the food that I grew up with. And because my parents' restaurant, after 37 years, my mother sold it to somebody who closed it up after about 6 months. He was undercapitalized. And so all of those years and the refinement of the recipes and everything was sort of lost. And so I thought, well, let's do that in a restaurant because I feel that in my bones. So I wanted to do it. And then after a while, I began to think, you know, this was not, you know, my love. My real love is for these regional cuisines of Mexico. And because when I do them in the restaurant, I'm working to create this really traditional flavor. But I have the freedom to put the stuff on a plate in a different way than I would do it if I was cooking for people in Mexico. It gave me a bit more freedom, and the people in my dining room loved the stuff. So I didn't have to justify certain things that I was doing the way I was having to justify it around the corner at Zinfandel.
Yeah.
So it was I found that to be a little bit more frustrating. And then after a while, we decided to sell our interest to Susan and Drew Goss that started it with us. and let them kind of take it. They wanted to take it off in another direction because something had to happen. It needed to evolve in one way or another. And the way that they wanted to evolve it was just right for them, but it just wasn't right for me. So after a couple of years, we decided to sell our interest in it to them. And actually, now over at Westtown Tavern, where they are, they're still doing a lot of those same dishes and doing them very, very well.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the thing I think about Westtown Tavern is, you know, it's, I love to go there, and the great thing about it is it's not expensive,
right,
but the quality of the food is very
high.
You know, one of the things I think about is, you know, a lot with all of these chefs who have become really successful, you know, they have their high-end concepts, you know, and it's, you know, and now in France you have some of these Michelin 3 stars doing, like, you know, Spoon or, you know, these lower-end things, but, you know,
do
you
have... If you eat at Spoon, it's not cheap.
Yeah, well, that's the truth. Absolutely.
It's not nearly as expensive as going to the top places,
but
it's still not that accessible.
It's true. Your food, you know, especially at Frontera, has always been relatively accessible, so I don't know that you even fall into that category, but do you have a sense that, you know, chefs have some kind of responsibility to, you know, because it's great to make all this great food, but if people can't eat it, you know, and it's like, you know, I love what Grant Atkins is doing, and I don't, who knows what the future holds for him, but it's like, how many people can, you know, go and spend $300 on a meal,
right,
and the democratization of good food is important as well, you
right,
know, especially the Frontera Foundation is an example of that, you know, by bringing great local produce. I mean, that's a great step to doing that, you know, but...
Oh, that's a really important issue to me. And you notice that we didn't start out with Topolobampo. We started out with Frontera. And that's because I wanted to enter at the mid-level, pay my dues there, develop a clientele there, and then do the restaurant that I'd always set out to do, which was Topolobampo. Because in Topolobampo, I get an opportunity to work with a lot more sort of difficult to produce dishes and sauces and ingredients that are hard to find or that we only get in really small supply. And I'd always wanted to be able to do that because for me it really is important to have that creative outlet. But I don't want to turn my back on people that appreciate good food but just can't afford those $300 meals. Not that Topolobampo's anywhere near a $300
right,
meal, but we find that, especially because so many people have my books or watch the TV show, they come to Frontera, and for many of them, Frontera is a huge reach for them financially, coming into town. They've made a huge effort to get there, and for them, and they say this to me regularly as I walk through the dining room, they'll say, "This is the nicest meal I have ever had in my life." And I love to hear people say that. You know, it's definitely not a cheap restaurant, but it's certainly not an expensive one. And so it's something that's sort of within a lot of people's reach, and I love being able to offer that to people. But then, of course, we just this last year went into an even simpler concept that's way more accessible to people, doing Fresco down at what is now Macy's.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that. What is now Macy's?
Right.
We put it into
Marshall Fields.
And now it is in a Macy's. The idea about that was to take good quality ingredients, freshly made stuff, but very simple, and do it in an environment where we really control everything so we can get the quality out there, but we can offer people, you know, a $7.95 entree that's just really good food. It's not, I mean, it's lunch kind of food, but it's really good food. And that's been really successful, and I'll tell you that the comments that I have heard the most from people is, thank you for giving us really good food that's cheap enough that we can afford it regularly. And that's really what I wanted to achieve with that.
Speaking of the Frontera Fresco, that brings up the idea of, you know, the Frontera Foods, that the business that you have. There was a really good article in Forbes about your partnership, and there was the sort of undercurrent of that article was a little bit the creative tension of that partnership, I think. You know, I think one of the examples was this idea that you had the Frontera salsas, and then, you know, you had the Salpica line, which is the Southwestern, which
for
you, when you had first heard that, you were like, oh, Southwestern, I don't know. And I wondered about this idea of, you know, as you grow more successful, there's no question in my mind that, you're very principled in what you do. But just this idea of business intermeshing with your ideals and the idea of compromise as it runs through your business. I know, you know, I think you got a lot of flack for the Burger King commercial, and but what people didn't know is that you were giving that money to your foundation or giving that to farmers, you know. But I just thought, how do you think about that tension of business and what you're trying to do with your ideals? And,
well, one of the things that we talk about a lot in our restaurant is that if we go out of business, then we can't help anybody. So we want to be very successful financially because we all have families. We all want to take care of ourselves. We all want to grow, not just professionally, but financially to provide for the people that we're providing for. And so we want to be financially successful in every endeavor that we go into. And at the same time, we want to figure out a way that we can bring our principles into that so that what we do, each step that we take, we do with real integrity and that it reflects back onto our mission of what we're really trying to accomplish in the overall scheme of things. And so we work very hard, and sometimes that means that we can't do everything that we would like to do, because if we did, it might compromise our financial health. And like I said, if we compromise that, then we're not any good to anybody. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the growth comes slowly in achieving the sort of mission of what we're doing, and other times it comes really quickly, depending on sort of what the circumstances are that present themselves to us. And I would love to, I mean, I have all these wonderful plans of things that I would like to do to make our restaurant culture, our prepared foods culture, even better at achieving the goals that I want to achieve in terms of our mission. Yet I can't do them all at one time because everything has to take one step at a time to keep the financial health of each organization intact. So I do what I can do, and I think we've come a long way in all of it, but there are certainly compromises in everything you have to do in life. I mean, I always say I would be a really, really good person to win the lottery, because I would put all that money to really good use. I don't know if it would make me a better person, however, because part of the things that I actually enjoy in life are jumping over hurdles, of figuring out a way to make it work. Like, we just, the company that we've gotten our beef from in the restaurant for the last almost 10 years now, it's a co-op of farms or ranches out in Montana. And they just disbanded, and we're not going to be able to get any beef from them. Mm-hmm. So that's a really big problem for us, because now we have to try to find a beef supply that fits in with everything that we believe here. So we've been working on this for about 4 or 5 months now. And everything, every choice that we have is going to involve a compromise in one way or another. Whether it's a financial compromise because the stuff's going to cost a lot more, or whether it's the fact that we got this great grass-fed beef, but it comes from Chile. And our goal is to have everything come from as close to home as possible. Chile ain't close to home, mm-hmm. So we're trying to figure out which of those choices we're going to take. It's tough. Yeah.
If you had won a huge lottery mm-hmm. settlement, how would that have changed the course of your life, or how would that change what you're doing with Frontera?
All of that. You know, we have the biggest recycling program of any restaurant in the city. And we don't do just the easy stuff like cans and bottles and cardboard, but we do 100% of all of our food waste, both pre- and post-consumer. And we do that in conjunction with Ken Dunn at the Resource Center. And it's a huge thing. We give him about 2 tons of compostable stuff a week. That's a lot of stuff to give to one person to do his compost with. I would help him to make his enterprise more, well, easier for other people to work with. We have to do a lot. We invest a lot in that kind of a project. But I would make that, you know, into something that everybody could do. I'd do a lot. I'd replace half my kitchen equipment with new stuff that's more fuel efficient. You know, there's all sure. kinds of little projects like that I want to put in a more energy efficient boiler system, but the whole thing's going to cost $20,000, and that's a big chunk of change for me to come up with right now when sure. When the one I've got's fully functioning, you know. And you know, there's little projects like that I would do. I'd give a lot more to the Frontera Farmer Foundation so we could spread that wealth yeah. out. There's a lot of projects that I'd work on.
You know, earlier we were talking about the tension between American culture and Mexican culture, and you know, one of the other things I think about in the restaurant industry, which is kind of a big issue, is that a lot of Latinos are sort of the backbone of the kitchen, and you know, whether they're dishwashing or whether they're working right. the line. But generally speaking, very few of those Latinos have transcended to be, you know, the center point chefs, although you've had a really good track record, I think, with Priscilla Sadkoff at Sal Picón and Gino Bahina, and you know, there's quite a few, I'm sure. And you know, I wondered, you know, what your thoughts in terms of, you know, why that, what's going on there, and maybe what you've done to encourage or, you know, help those chefs succeed. Or,
well, a couple of different things. One is that culture does not really encourage people to think on their own and be very creative unless you come from a certain class of people in Mexico. And that's not the class that's immigrating here. So they're taught to, in school, to recite, to just regurgitate the facts and get all of that stuff right and don't think very much beyond it. And I think that's one of the reasons that they make great sous chefs, because they can learn everything, but then the creativity is coming from the chef. They can execute amazingly. And that is, I think, one of the major reasons that our service industry, in whatever aspect, has really taken to Latinos, because they do a really, really wonderful, they're just naturally adept at many different things that are necessary for working in service. The flip side of that is that a lot of the young Mexican chefs sense a lack of respect for their cuisine in the United States, and so they would never occur to them to want to pursue doing fine Mexican cuisine. In fact, a lot of them come from poor homes and they didn't have very much. They don't even know much about it. And I hear that from a number of the young Mexican chefs that, well, lots of them do Italian food and they do it really, really well, that what their goal in life is to go to Italy and learn the real Italian food there, because, well, there really isn't that much to Mexican food. And I said, oh man, have you ever been to Veracruz? Have you ever tasted Oaxacan moles and all that? And they're sort of, their eyes get big and they go, well, I don't even know what you're talking about. I've never tasted anything like that. I mean, we grew up eating beans and rice and a simple tomato and pork stew every once in a while, but certainly not the wonders that you can find in certain areas in Mexico where the cuisine is very refined and varied and seasonal and all that sort of stuff. So it's partly about who the immigrant class is that comes here, and partly about their experience with their own cuisine, but also a sense of lack of respect, I think, on Americans' parts about Mexican food. And that's one of the reasons that I have, I think, been successful at what I've done, because I can articulate all of that stuff. I've been to every single state in Mexico. I've learned from the regional cooks how to prepare those dishes. I've done my homework with it all, and I can sort of hold my own with practically anybody when you're talking sort of the minor regional specialties of Mexico. And I'm very comfortable in the culture, and I love it. I find it one of the most fascinating, warm, rich cultures in the whole world. And so that's what I present when I'm writing books or when I'm doing TV shows or even when we're making menus here in our restaurant. And because I'm not Latino, that's either good or bad, depending on which side of the fence you're on. But if you're looking at it from the good side, you can say, I have had that opportunity to go, and from an outsider's perspective, I don't have a Mexican grandma, so I don't have to be sort of given to her way of doing it and respect that and say everything else is wrong, which is another one of the things that you find a lot in Mexico. But I don't have a Mexican grandmother, so I can love everybody's Mexican grandmother. I can say they all are great cooks, and I'm not betraying anybody's trust. And I can say, yeah, when you go to Veracruz, you got to taste all of this kind of stuff over here, and in Oaxaca this, and in Mexico City that, or Puebla, wherever it might be. Those are all the cuisines that I can adopt as my own because I didn't come from anywhere in Mexico. I went in with my eyes wide open and a researcher's background, so I was able to sort of turn over a lot of stones and make them all my cuisine. You don't find very many people in Mexico that can do that. There are some people that complain that I'm doing all this stuff and yet I'm not Mexican. And yet, there's nobody coming out of Mexico that's doing it, mm-hmm. you know? And I say, well, please, I would like all these people to come in here and show me what they know about the cuisine. But what you find mostly in the United States is a lot of people who talk about what their grandmother made. Mm-hmm. And their grandmother made a nice group of 12 different dishes, but that does not a restaurant menu make,
right.
you
right.
know? And certainly when you're talking about the nature of restaurant work in the United States, where it's all about evolution and working on your menu and creating things that are seasonal and all that, you got to have a wide variety to pull from.
One of the things I read that you talked about how people come to Frontera, like you said, that's a stretch for them sometimes, or they're coming from all over the United States, and one of the conversations they inevitably have with you is, where should I eat in Chicago? And mm-hmm. often it's sort of, where's the best pizza or where the best hot dogs are? And your tendency is to direct them, or you want to direct them to what, you know, the great ethnic joints that we have, mm-hmm. Thai food or Mexican. And one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, because I've been working on an article, is Tacos al Pastor. And I wondered, I know Frontera does a great version, I wondered if there was were a few places around town that you've had, you know, that were special or really good tacos al pastor in Chicago.
I'm not sure how to answer that. You know, the truth is that I don't eat tacos al pastor here very much at all. I have my real favorite places in Mexico City that I go to, and I kind of and in Puebla, and I kind of save up my tacos al pastor to eat there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that
so
makes sense.
I don't really eat that much. It's very interesting that, you know, my favorite Mexican food in Chicago is what I eat down at Maxwell Street
yeah.
Market. And when it comes to I eat 10 meals a week in my own restaurant. So on the weekends, I'm usually up for Chinese food or
sure.
something completely different, and we like to cook at home too, so I tend to make a lot of stuff from my childhood at home, and
uh-huh.
so my daughter has a little taste of that too and all, but so I don't get out to a whole lot of the other Mexican restaurants in Pilsen, Little Village, around. Every once in a while I'll go to them, and like we go down every once in a while and eat carnitas at Don Pedro, and I really like what they do down there. But then we go to Maxwell Street regularly, especially in the warmer months, and we'll go down and eat the huaraches or the seafood mm-hmm. soup or the birria or something like that. And I just, or tacos of steak.
Sure.
And I love that because yeah. that really reminds me of being in Mexico and eating in the markets.
Yeah. No, it's a favorite of mine as well. I love like the mole at Manolo's. And
did you ever try at Doña Rosa? That's my favorite mole. She's from Guerrero, and I think she makes really wonderful.
I have to check it out.
Now, they, like, if you're entering at 14th Street by mm-hmm. the parking area over there, if you enter there, they'll be on your right-hand side. At least they were. They've moved from the middle aisle over to that, so they're closer to that parking area. And they make handmade large, thick tortillas,
mm-hmm.
and they make a lot of quesadillas and different things, but she always makes a pot of mole. And it's good stuff.
I'll look for it.
Look for it, because it's really good.
Two more questions.
Yeah.
you know, I'm expecting my first kid in March.
And, oh, you're good.
Yeah, and thank you. And you know, of course, as somebody who loves food, I think a lot about, you know, the raising a child in a food world and having them conscious. And certainly you've done a good job with your daughter, Lainey, who've written a cookbook together.
Right.
You know, I wondered if you thought about it consciously, if there's anything you've done over time, you know, in raising a child in the food world and how you do that.
Well, I have to say my daughter is not precocious, okay? A lot of people think that she must be, but she has very simple tastes. And if you look at that book, she had to approve every single thing that went in there. And because there's that dialogue between me and her through the book about the flavors, the cooking of the recipes and all that, you can really get a sense of whether it was her favorite dish or not. If she didn't like the dish, we didn't include it in the book. So we had to sift through a whole lot of stuff because we were dealing with some pretty exotic things as we traveled around the world and ate with families. So some places it was hard to come up with enough dishes to fill out a chapter that she really liked, and she's got very simple taste. I say my saving grace was that she always liked salmon and salad, okay? So going out to a lot of places, there's a salad, and a lot of times there's salmon on the menu, especially in Europe and in the United States. So that kind of saved me because she could always sort of gravitate to that. But she doesn't like a lot of different stuff on one plate. And she's got it in her head. She really wants to go to Alinea. Mm-hmm. And she wants to go because it's supposed to be sort of bizarre and wild. But I don't know how much of everything she's going to eat once she gets there. But I've raised her in a way, hopefully, that she knows what is out there. Not that she likes it all, but she knows and she's really comfortable with it. So that as her tastes evolve, and they're certainly evolving a lot now because she's hit 15 and so she's really opening to a lot of new things, that she will feel comfortable with those things. She knows they exist and so forth. But she's gone through periods where she wanted to like shrink what she ate to about 5 different things. And then she'd broaden back out again. And sometimes I pack her lunch every day, so I have to deal with all of this stuff. And what she's going to eat and all that, what kind of flavor she likes. And will she take that leftover or not, that leftover? No, I just ate that last night because I knew I had to eat, you know, and stuff like that. But I don't want to take it for lunch tomorrow. Yeah. So it's a very interesting challenge and adventure. And all I wanted to do was to make sure that she was more taken with fresh food than processed food. And I think I've been successful at that. When her friends say they want to go eat at McDonald's or whatever, she'll say, let's go to the deli over there because the food's fresher over there. And I'm really happy to hear that's her way of dealing with the peer pressure and everything. There was a time when she was going to a program and, you know, those things that you can buy called Lunchables. Mm-hmm. Have you seen those in the grocery?
Okay.
So she had to have Lunchables. And so I said, okay, well, we'll make a deal. One day a week, I will send Lunchables with you, but the rest of the week, you're going to just eat our food here. But she was just in tears one night because all the kids were eating Lunchables, and she felt like she was being left out. So I said, okay, once a week, I'll buy you your Lunchables. So I had to go. They don't carry Lunchables at Whole Foods. So we had to go to a special grocery store and buy the Lunchables for her to do, and thank goodness that era left.
Yes, yes. I know you throw a lot of dinner parties. It's just a question I like to ask, and then you've probably had a lot of people over that you wanted to talk to over time as a result, but if you were throwing a dinner party, do you have a sense of maybe what an ideal guest list, people you haven't been able to talk to, alive or dead, doesn't matter, you know, people that you might want to speak with that you haven't had a chance to, or, you know, serve food with, break bread with?
God.
I'm sure the list is long.
I'm terrible at these questions.
Yeah.
I can think about it and get back to you about it, but I'm not. That's not an easy thing for me to do.
Yeah, I think that even if you reduce it, the question is: there somebody, you know, in history that you think about or that you really admire or that you know you've always wanted to talk with? You know.
Well, that's kind of interesting. The couple of people that come to my mind. It's sort of bizarre. One is Thomas Jefferson. I wonder what it would have been like to... I wonder what kind of person he really was. I mean, we have our concept of who we think he was in terms of his knowledge of food and wine and commitment to developing all this stuff in a new land and all that. So I think that would have been... It would be really interesting to sit down with him and have dinner and see what it was really like. The other person is my grandmother, who died when I was younger, who was a major influence on me and my cooking when I was younger. And I'd love to meet her as an adult,
mm-hmm.
and get to know her, because
mm-hmm.
she was really a very fascinating person. I had the opportunity to have dinner with Julia Child, who was the other woman that was really important in my growing up and relationship to food. And I had the opportunity to do that one time, but it was with a big group of people. And I would love to have the opportunity to actually do the small dinner party where we could really talk about
sure.
things.
Private audience with Julia.
Yeah, she was just an amazing... I was on her show once, and that was when it was her 82nd birthday, and she was just a dynamo. Just unbelievable. Really, really enjoyed my experience with her. I had met her, a couple of times before, but just to shake hands and say hello, and she'd eaten at our restaurant a couple of times. I had that opportunity to have dinner with her, but it was with a big group of people.
I was thinking as we were talking, you said that you'd like to cook at home sometimes the things of your childhood, and I know you grew up in a barbecue restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, do you barbecue, or do you like the...
I do barbecue 2 or 3 times a year, and I do it once in the summer and once in the winter for sure. In the winter, because it's just fun to be barbecuing in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
And we do all this sort of very summery food and invite... Actually, my daughter makes the guest list for that party, and she usually invites her friends and their families to come over. So we just have a big barbecue blowout, and then we do another big barbecue blowout in the summertime where we... And both times the menu is exactly the same. It's the menu from my parents' restaurant, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote about it in the book that I did with my daughter. And it's because we said we went all over the world and cooked with families, but there's a chapter in Oklahoma there because my daughter was born at the same year that my parents' restaurant was sold. So she never got a chance to see that place. But she's grown up with the sort of myth, the folklore of what barbecue life was like in Oklahoma and what it was like for me to be raised in that family restaurant. And so every year we do this menu a couple of different times. And it's a big part of sort of our family's identity that we continue on with all of that. And then the story that I talked about in the book with Lainey was when I invited my sister and my mother to come up and cook the whole menu with me, because I've been cooking it for years, but I wanted them to come up and cook it with me, and I was sure that all kinds of Norman Rockwell moments would happen, and it was totally the opposite. The recipes had all evolved in our own heads in different ways, because the restaurant had been gone for a decade, and so there we were cooking away, and my mother said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm doing whatever." And she said, "That's not the way we do it." And my sister would look over and go, no, it's this way. And my mother said, "No, it's this way." And what we ended up with was a mess at the end of the day. All the food was terrible. It was the worst version of all of that food I've ever tasted, because we finally realized that after a while of bickering at each other and saying that, "No, you're supposed to do it this way," that we were all compromising and trying to do a little bit of this and not quite enough of that. And we turned out bad food in the end. And we all laughed at the end of the day because every single thing we made was bad. And so I wrote down the recipes my way and said, "Sorry, guys, this is my version of it."
That's funny. And your brother is Skip Bayless from ESPN,
right.
Is that right?
Yes.
It must have been an amazing, interesting family growing up. Because he's kind of a rabble-rouser on ESPN.
He's a rabble-rouser, but in real life, he's super quiet.
Is he?
And he's a real hermit.
Yeah.
He doesn't participate. He doesn't have hardly any friends. He just does his work, and that's it.
Yeah.
He's always been that way, though.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Chefs on the Grill. If you have any feedback or you'd like to hear us talk to a particular food personality, drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com. In the meantime, stay hungry.
Four, three, two.
One more time.